Okay, we're going to go into James chapter 1. We're looking at verse 15 this evening. And the topic of our study is the statement that he made in that verse about when lust hath conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it reaches its full end, brings forth death. And we want to consider the death effect of sin and see what we can understand from it in our interaction with our daily experiences. We've been looking in James at temptation primarily, but we've recognized from the beginning that any difficult situation that comes into our life bears this temptation with it, because in every stressful situation, and not even the stressful, not just the stressful ones, even the good times, often carry with them the impetus for decision making. And the decisions that are made need to be made according to the wisdom of God. And many, many times, the lack of wisdom results in choices that end up creating a situation or an atmosphere of death, and we sometimes don't even realize what happened. So this evening, we want to look into this matter. We spent most of our time last week going over a grocery list of about 5 different factors that enable temptation to succeed in our lives. And we're basically following the point that he made in verse 14, that the roots of temptation are internal. That is, the roots of success are internal. We've seen that external temptation has no hope of success unless there's first an internal dissatisfaction with something. It is impossible to get someone who's contented and satisfied to move into something else. There has to be the creation of some sort of a dissatisfaction before they'll move. And of course, the sense of dissatisfaction can be real or imagined. Adam and Eve obviously didn't have any real basis for dissatisfaction in the provision in the garden. There was absolutely nothing lacking there for them in any sense of that term, lack. But Satan was able to create a sense of dissatisfaction and then was able to move them. So I think that that carries through. I don't think that temptation that comes from without ever has any real hope for success unless, first of all, there's some kind of an internal drivenness. And that's what he says in verse 14 when he says each one is tempted when he's carried away and enticed by his own lust or strong desire. Now, I want you to remember that verse 13 says God cannot be tempted by evil. And that definition of that term evil means a lack that motivates a person to try to fill it apart from the wisdom and direction of God. And so this evening, with that in our background, we want to go on into verse 15, where he talks about lust conceiving, giving birth to sin, and sin, when it's accomplished, brings forth death. Now I'm going to ask a series of questions, and I want us to interact with them. When he puts this up here this way, that sin brings forth death, it seems to be fairly apparent that he is putting up a reality that would be designed to keep us from moving in that direction. And that raises a question that I want to ask, and that is, what is the problem of death as the final consequence of sin?
God.
Is that a problem?
Death is separation. Separation from something.
Is that a problem?
Separation from God is death.
Well,
when you say that death is separation from something, separation from God or separation from your body or whatever. Yeah, I mean, there are 3 different levels of death, because there's 3 different aspects of our identity. There's physical death for the body, and there's relational death for the soul, and there's spiritual death for the spirit. And all 3 of those have a particular impact on the individual. But what is the problem with that? There are lots and lots of people who are already living apart from God, and it doesn't seem to bother them a great deal. So what's the problem of being separated from God forever?
They're living apart from God, but they're not living apart from the things that God has provided. That's
okay.
Mean, you still get the sunshine. They plant a tree, it grows apples just as much as maybe more than mine is, because I wouldn't spray mine.
Okay.
But so on and so forth. So they're not apart from God as we know it. They may be apart from.
What are they actually? What are they actually separated from when we say they're separated from God? God is omnipresent. He's everywhere all the time. And so what is the real issue of separation from God? Good. All good answers. What's the problem with being separated from Him?
When death comes, it'll be absent of all good if you have eternal torment.
Okay. If we define it as absence of all good. What is the condition, the final condition of the dead? We're talking around some things here. I want us to nail them down. The psalmist said even if he made his bed in hell, God would be there. So in the sense of omnipresence, God is even in Gehenna. Their awareness of Him is not going to be. One thing you need to keep in mind, dead people are going to be raised with indestructible bodies. They have a date with eternity they cannot get out of. They have an everlasting future. They're not infinite in their being because they had a beginning, but as far as their future is concerned, there's no end. So the condition of the dead outside of Christ are that they're resurrected to a body that can't be destroyed, and they can't get out of their situation ever. So that's the bottom line, at least those are the most basic issues of the bottom line. What is the final problem? I mean, why don't you want to go to hell? Some people say, well, I don't mind, I'm going to go. Okay, when you talk about being punished, what are you talking about? All right, now we're getting down to the nitty-gritty. The bottom line issue probably is going to be pain at all three levels. If Jesus' analogy of cutting your arm off so that you don't go into hell if your arm offends you, if that analogy has any weight at all, He's obviously implying that the physical level of torment in Gehenna is not going to be what we would consider bearable, but it will have to be borne. There isn't any way out of it. At the relational level, there is going to be a total absence of the grace elements of God's work, even in the heart and minds of unbelievers, so that there is going to be no civility, no cooperation for mutual benefit of any kind. It's going to be total antagonism by every individual toward every individual. That's the breakdown of relationships to the maximum. And then at the spiritual level, the spirit of man was created by God to accomplish good for man. And the rejection by God at the great white throne when He says, "You're worthless to me," that is going to be the maximized humiliation that man can face as a spirit being. Plus, there is absolutely nothing he can do in Gehenna to resolve the problems that the soul is facing with the absolute antagonism of every individual and the physical problems of the torment of the flame. So I think that we can summarize the real problem at this level. Probably saying that this is the bottom line issue is a post-Genesis 3 conclusion. Most of us are self-interested enough to realize that this is the problem. So when James says that sin, when it is finished or has accomplished its end, it brings forth death, he's obviously introducing a fundamental issue, and that is the issue of values. What is important? And if we go along the lines of our bottom line definition here, obviously what is important has something to do with escaping, being delivered from, but there's a positive aspect too, being delivered into. All right, if we're going to make the essence of death pain, what is the essence of life? Hey, good for you.
Peace.
Good for you. Took the folks in Butte longer than you did to get that. Now, technically, not exactly the opposite. The opposite of joy would probably be something like rage.
The opposite
of pain would be pleasure. Yeah. And pleasure in the physical, relational, and spiritual areas is what life's all about. That's how God defines life for man. Life for man is living in a land of plenty with people who love each other with some significant task to accomplish. That's God's definition of life for man. Physically, emotionally or relationally, and spiritually. It all boils down to satisfaction or pleasure at all three levels, relationally, spiritually, and physically. But this is the term that seems to surface mostly in the New Testament. Now, when we talk about James trying to dissuade us from succumbing to temptation, because that's what verses 13, 14, and 15 are about. He's trying to dissuade us from giving in. He brings up the specter of death at the end of verse 15 because it brings up the question, what is really the bottom line in terms of what is important and what makes things important? What creates importance? Because I noticed, for example, that when we said joy was the essence of life, I also heard the word peace. Well, peace is a mechanism word. If you have peace between yourself and your environment, your body will enjoy pleasure. If you have antagonism between your environment and your body, you're going to have pain. If you have peace in your relationships, you're going to have emotional pleasure. And if you have conflict in your relationships, you're going to have emotional pain. If you have peace between you and the efforts you're making to accomplish whatever task you've set before you, that is, you're being successful, you're going to have pleasure in your spirit. And if your efforts are being frustrated by something, then you're going to be angry and bitter because of your frustration at the spiritual level. So this is a mechanism word, and it defines the fundamental mechanism of joy. Because peace is the first thing you get when you're justified by faith. That's Romans chapter 5, verse 1. Therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God. And that peace is the foundation then for the joy and exalting that goes on in the rest of chapter 5, even in our tribulation. So the point is this issue of what is important and why it's important. Obviously, we've decided that what is important is life and escape from death. And what makes things important is their contribution to the escape or to the entrance, depending on which of these two you're talking about. Something is important if it helps you escape from death. It's important if it helps you to go into life. Otherwise, it's not important. It has no value. Now, I realize this is kind of a utilitarian definition, but it's the one that people identify with.
The thing, if we're really going to enter into life, we have to escape through death. There's no other way for us to escape this chain of, that we're bound to.
Yeah, at the physical level, that's true.
So, I mean, if we're going to look forward to that heavenly where those things are complete peace and ultimate joy and total eternal life, we then have to face the fact that
we're going to
the
die.
The consequence of death is a privilege for us.
Yeah, for believers.
As a believer.
That's why,
a victory for us to walk through that.
That's why Hebrews says that Jesus delivered those who were in bondage all their lifetime to the fear of death, because he became their satisfaction for the sin that they owed. And so believers really have absolutely no basis for fearing death, unless, of course, they're not walking with the Lord, and then they can fear being ashamed before him, because that's what's going to happen when they die. They're going to go into his presence, and they're going to feel the shame of having not walked with him while they were living. physically on the planet. But as far as being afraid or subject to the issues of the pain, Jesus took that. The penalty has been assessed on him. And just for your pondering, I want to say this again. I know I've said it before. But when Jesus took our sin upon himself and suffered the breach at every level, physically and relationally with the Father and the Spirit and spiritually, when he suffered that breach, he endured the reality of hell sufficiently for the sins of every human being who's ever lived, and actually probably didn't minimize it to that, because he was infinite in his deity, and whatever he suffers, he suffers. Everything is immediately present to God always. So that, put this in your pipe and smoke it, Jesus is still consciously aware of the price he was paying on Calvary 2,000 years ago, and he's still aware of it for you and me. You know, we don't have a Savior that suffered for a couple, 3 or 4 hours and got it all done and over with. There is a sense in which whatever happens to God happens to him forever, and that's one of the reasons why hell is, because when I sin against God, I owe an infinite price I can't pay, because I've sinned against an infinite being. There's no way I can pay that kind of price. But I'm not sure it's just memory for God. I don't know, but I'm not sure it's just memory. I don't know enough about the sensibilities of God to know whether or not there are some things that are done with and forgotten or over with. And yeah, he does. I'm not sure, though, that the pain is gone forever. What I'm trying to drive at, though, is James wanted us to do some clear thinking about what is the final value, what is the bottom line. And the very warning itself implies that there is a whole issue of what I would call conflicts of values, because what is temptation if it is not an attempt to subvert the values? Temptation is always an attempt to put a lesser value above a greater one, always. So that in every temptation you're going to be faced with a higher ideal and a lower solution to your problem. And if you go for the lower, you have sinned, because you have taken an out that God didn't grant you. That's why James talks in verses 2 through 11 particularly about enduring, hanging in there until in the wisdom of God you discover how he would have you handle it. And sometimes the way he would have you handle it resolves it, and then you're free from that. But sometimes the way he would have you handle it means that you are committing yourself for probably a good part of your lifetime to no escape from that particular situation. And that's, of course, the whole issue is in verses 14 and 15. Our lusts are simply powerful drivers motivating us to try to cash in on life by the mechanisms of death. That's all it is. It's an attempt to get us to cash in now on life, but the only mechanisms that are available for us now are the mechanisms of death. So temptation is, well, do it. Do it. You'll get the relief you're looking for. You'll get the satisfaction you're looking for. You'll get the pleasure you're looking for. Just do it. But when that conceives, suddenly there's a whole different ball game going on. Now, I want you to think in terms of life and death in relation to the essence of God. God is spirit. He has no body. And that means that his fundamental focus is on relational issues, because they're not on physical issues. So that life is defined by God in terms of healthy relationships, peace between persons. Now, given that, what is the imagery of verses 14 and 15? When it talks about being carried away and enticed, those words mean baited and seduced. What is the imagery there in plain old language? What kind of image is he trying to create in our minds when a person is tempted, carried away, and enticed? What? So what's the imagery? Yeah, it's the prostitute and the guy. It's the old Proverbs, is it 4 or 5 or somewhere along in there, where the young man goes, foolish man goes along, and then there's this woman. And he doesn't know that her steps are to the are downward to the house of death. Well, I want you to think about this briefly. If the picture here is of a man and a harlot, that seems to be what's going on here. He's saying that we have in ourselves both this male-female reality that's going on, because he says it's in you. Every person is enticed from within, tempted and enticed from within. But think about it for a minute. When a guy goes walking by a prostitute, how temptable is he? Well, that kind of depends on his own inner sense of satisfaction. And if he's perfectly contented and satisfied, she poses no temptation. In fact, she'll be repulsive to him because of the moral issues. But if he's deeply dissatisfied and his lusts are driving him, then he's set up. What's the prostitute got in? I mean, what's she in this for? The guy is obviously looking for sexual relief. What's the girl, what's the prostitute looking for? She's not looking for that.
Money.
Why? Okay, how's she defining life?
She's got her own desires.
Exactly. So what we end up having here is a split agenda. We've got, within ourselves, we've got a split agenda. We've got one set of desires that want to be satisfied, and we've got another, if we can call it an entity, that's saying, well, I've got some things I want too, and I'll trade you. Now, given that, I want you to go back to the imagery of the creation account in Genesis 2 and realize that God created a body, and he put in that body a spirit to give it life, and then the combination made a living soul. And in the scriptures, the soul is passive, the spirit is active, and it comes down to being like a man and a woman. And that's the imagery of two becoming one flesh. The male and the female, the male as the initiator, the female as the helper. That imagery apparently exists in every individual, whether they're male or female. And the point that he's trying to talk about here is what we call conflicts of values, agenda clashes. And he presents it in relation to the female aspect as being seductive for her own agenda, and the male as being lustful and having an agenda for that. But it's here. She's looking for one thing and he's looking for another. Now, given that imagery, what he's saying then is that in every situation that we run into, we have two things going on. We have a spirit that is trying to make points in terms of significance or status, and we have a soul that's trying to make points in terms of relational security, and they're at odds with one another, just like husbands and wives are. Husbands who go after the job and wives who want the home fires going, where the relationships all go. The point that James is trying to make is that we live, every one of us live with this conflict inside, unless we have found peace with God. And that's why I said a week or two ago, it's impossible for man to sense a lack until he first turns his back on the God who constantly supplies. You can't be tempted by evil, which is a lack, with a drive to satisfy it through an ungodly way. You can't be tempted by evil unless you have walked away from the light. So, this conflict of values only exists after we have departed from God. And why would we do that? Same reason. Conflict of values. He has an agenda, and I have one. And they're not the same. And when he won't bend, I walk. That's how temptation works. Now, I want you to notice in the last couple of minutes the implications of this conception-death cycle here, because he says that once a person has been tempted and carried away, lust conceives. In other words, the woman is now pregnant. And as soon as that happens, this whole thing has moved into another realm. It takes on a life of its own. There is now a baby coming, and the baby's name is sin. And when sin has come full grown, its result is death. And what he's trying to say is, you got to cut this thing off before conception. Because if you don't, it'll be out of your hands. We live in a cause and effect universe. We cannot act without reaction coming. It's just going to be that way. And that's one of the most fundamental things we've got to come to grips with. We live in a cause and effect universe. So if we succumb to temptation, Katie, bar the door. The baby's coming. And when it comes, death is just down the road. The imagery is extremely graphic because James wants us to stop and realize the time to deal with the issues of temptation and sin are at the temptation level before you give in and lust conceives. Because if you give in, death is coming. There isn't any escape. Now, we have to understand that there are multiple levels of death. Death can be as small as a little sticker in your finger. I mean, that's a level of death. It's environmental conflict between your body and your environment, and it creates pain, and so that's a form of death. It can be as minor as that, or it can be as horrendous as a, you know, eternal burning flame. No searing of the senses. It can be anywhere between. And so when we say, for example, well, I got away with it, nothing happened. Oh, no, you didn't. There are two problems. One is we may not have lived long for it, what is going to happen to happen. And the second thing is what happened, we may be so jaded in our experience of death that we just accept that extra level of death without, but it does something to us. That's why you have so many bitter and frustrated and angry people. Is because all of these consequences are coming back on them, and their death effects have been brought on by their own rebellion against God, and it makes them angry.
If Bob Seaman has the whole vocabulary that he uses, some of it was pretty graphic.
Oh, yeah.
Scar tissue on the soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That really is pretty good.
You know, there are multiple ways that you can illustrate. James simply wanted, he pulled up the male-female conflict thing, but what he wanted us to see was the kid. And the end result, when this kid is full-blown, it's death. And he did that on purpose because he wants us to realize the gravity of our life choices. He could have been a whole lot more positive and talked about the life impact of choosing right, but you know, sinners don't. They don't respond to that. The Bible says the goodness of God is designed to lead us to repentance. But how many people do you know have come to God because he's blessed them so much? Generally speaking, people come to God because he's hammered them somehow or another. We're sinners. We respond to pain. And we spoil on pleasure rather than revel in the goodness of God. So we have to be careful. And we have to understand that James 1 is simply telling us, look, given our fallenness, our tribulations work patience, and patience produces godly character. If sin had never entered, it wouldn't have to be that way. And it's not going to be that way forever, but now it is that way. The Bible never gives much encouragement that people who are prosperous and wealthy will grow up in all things like Christ. Okay, any other comments or observations? we're fixing to quit. We've run out of time.